From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And something else is different about this new era. Our response to terrorism has changed because George W. Bush is president of the United States.
And a particularly close ally of the Saudi regime. A new congressional report is out saying Riyadh may have given hijackers of September 11th financial and logistical support, though the White House has classified many of the pages relating to its Middle East ally. We will speak with Robert Fisk just out of Baghdad, also a former CIA analyst. And we'll take a look at Monsanto. It is suing a Vermont dairy because it dared to say it is hormone-free. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The reports, after delaying its publication for months, the Bush administration yesterday released the congressional investigation on the September 11th attacks. The report's findings provide an even more damning indictment of the intelligence community than many predicted. Florida Democratic Senator Bob Graham, former head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, says the report proves the 9/11 attacks could have been stopped. The scathing critique of the CIA and the FBI finds the agencies did not talk to each other at critical junctures. The FBI missed evidence of its own informant who actually lived with two of the hijackers in San Diego. The U.S. government also deleted 28 pages of the report believed to detail Saudi funding of members of al-Qaeda in the United States prior to September 11th. We'll have more on this story in a few minutes. As fighting intensifies in Liberia, the top two Pentagon officials and the Joint Chiefs of Staff are warning about the dangers of U.S. involvement in the West African nation. This highlights a split between the State Department and the Pentagon. Secretary of State General Colin Powell recently called for U.S. troops to be sent to Liberia. General Richard Myers said yesterday, it's not a pretty situation. It's not going to give way to any instant fix. Representative Donald Payne, a New Jersey Democrat, charged the top Pentagon officials with racism, saying that they are reluctant to help Liberia, an African country. Payne said there's no question they don't want to go near Liberia. It's because they're African, they're black, and they don't count. The U.S. yesterday released the bloody and grisly photos of two men they identified as Uday and Qusay Hussein, the sons of former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. According to the Guardian of London, the release of the photos were delayed 24 hours because of an intense debate between military officials and the Pentagon's civilian leadership. Head military officers protested the decision to release the photos. Colonel Dan Smith, a retired military intelligence officer, said, quote, "We have a tradition of respecting the dead. We objected to the showing bodies of American servicemen. It's kind of ironic we turn around and display dead folks now." But Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld defended the decision. He argued it would help convince the world Saddam's sons were dead. It is unclear how successful that's been. The Guardian reports one Iraqi newspaper claimed to have conducted an instant poll in which 80% of Iraqis questioned that they thought that the pictures were a fabrication. The New York Times is reporting House Majority Leader Tom DeLay is heading to Israel, Jordan, and Iraq this week to voice his opposition to a Palestinian state. In the past, he's called the peace plan a roadmap to destruction. DeLay said, quote, "I can't imagine in the very near future that a Palestinian state could ever happen. I can't imagine this president supporting a state of terrorists, a sovereign state of terrorists." The New York Times describes DeLay as the most prominent member in Washington of the Christian Zionist movement. California's lieutenant governor has set October 7th to be the date of California's first ever gubernatorial recall election. Voters will be asked whether to recall Democrat Governor Gray Davis and on the same ballot to select a candidate to succeed Davis if he gets bounced from office. Ignoring concerns of labor unions, the U.S. House of Representatives has approved new trade agreements with Chile and Singapore. The Senate's expected to vote next week. Big businesses lobbied for the agreements, arguing it will open up new markets for U.S. goods. But opponents, including a growing number of Republicans, say the agreements will simply help multinational corporations move jobs from the United States. Congressmember Tom Tancredo, a Republican from Colorado, said, quote, "I'm becoming less and less of a free trader. All we've done is kowtow to multinational corporations and their desire to reduce labor costs." Lori Wallach, head of Public Citizen, also noted the pacts lack vital labor and environmental guarantees. Wallach said if these rules are applied to large blocks of countries, as the administration proposes, the results would be disastrous. An Argentine judge has ordered the arrest of 46 former officials connected to the military junta that ruled between 1976 and 1983. Thousands of supporters of the former Guatemalan dictator Efraín Ríos Montt have been rioting in the streets protesting a court ruling barring him from running for president. The BBC reports a journalist died after being chased by supporters of Montt. The Guatemalan president has ordered troops to restore order. Montt ruled in the 80s after overseeing a military coup. Thousands of civilians died under his rule. Guatemalan law bars former coup leaders from running for president. And this weekend marks the 50th anniversary of two of the major events of the 20th century. On July 26, 1953, the Cuban Revolution began when Fidel Castro and 200 supporters attacked military barracks in the eastern town of Santiago de Cuba. And on July 27, 1953, the Korean War ended with a ceasefire agreement. Tell me, baby girl, 'cause I need to know. Need to know, Mark Anthony here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And Amy, this is also the 105th anniversary today of the United States invasion of Puerto Rico on July 25th of 1898. 105 years of Puerto Rico being held as a colony of the United States, the most lucrative colony in the history of the United States. Mm-hmm. And we've also gotten word, obviously, of the Congress has released its long-awaited report of its intelligence committees on the September 11th attacks. The nearly 900-page report was based on the interviews of hundreds of U.S. and foreign officials and a review of hundreds of thousands of FBI and CIA files. The report report's findings provide an even more damning indictment of the intelligence community than many had predicted. The scathing critique of the CIA and the FBI finds that the agencies did not talk to each other at critical junctures, most notably on intelligence related to two of the hijackers. The FBI missed evidence of its own informant who was actually living with two of the hijackers in San Diego. The agency failed to keep tabs on warnings that Omar al-Bayoumi, a key associate of two of the hijackers and suspected Saudi government secret agent, met with Saudi government officials and the hijackers.
The FBI missed the opportunity in large part because the CIA had failed to share information about the hijackers it had 2 years prior to the attacks, the report says. It concludes the informant's contacts with the two hijackers would have offered, quote, the best chance to unravel the September 11th plot. The report may also implicate a foreign government in the attacks, longtime U.S. ally Saudi Arabia. The report finds the Saudi Arabian government thwarted efforts to prevent the rise of al-Qaeda and stop attacks, as well as provided financial and logistical support to the Saudi-born 911 hijackers. 15 of the 19 were from Saudi Arabia. Large sections of the report explaining how the Saudis did not cooperate remains classified. The Washington Post reports an entire 28-page section detailing whether Saudi Arabia was somehow implicated and 911 is blacked out. This despite a 7-month campaign by congressional investigators and others to have them made public.
The CIA argued that full disclosure of the details could upset relations with a key U.S. ally. Meanwhile, the White House resisted efforts to pin down Bush's knowledge of al-Qaeda threats and to catalog the executive's pre-September 11th counterterrorism strategy. Finally, the report reveals that U.S. intelligence had no evidence that Iraq or Saddam Hussein had any involvement in the attack or connection to al-Qaeda. Former Democratic Georgia Senator Max Cleland, who served on the congressional committees, charged the Bush administration purposely delayed the release of the 911 report until after the Iraq invasion.
We're joined right now by Melvin Goodman. He is a former CIA and State Department analyst, a senior fellow now at the Center for International Policy, director of its National Security Project, author of the forthcoming book, Bush League Diplomacy, Putting the Nation at Risk. He's also a professor at the National War College. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't you start off what you think, based on going through the report, what are its most startling conclusions?
Well, the most important conclusions deal, first of all, with George Tenet himself as the director of CIA. Clearly, what the report establishes was that he couldn't coordinate intelligence within his own agency, that he wasn't an arbitrator of intelligence within the intelligence community, and therefore failed in his job as director of Central Intelligence. One very telling point that's in the report is that in 1999, he issued a declaration of a war on terror, but he followed this up with nothing. There were no additional personnel given to the task. There was no additional sense of mission or sense of purpose. And no additional dollars were thrown at this problem. And half of the intelligence community either had no idea he had issued such a declaration or that it was designed for them. The second startling fact that comes through in the report, and some of it is buried within the report itself, is the incredible analytical failure of the CIA. The fact that they never examined a scenario involving an attack on the United States, the fact that in 1995 they did their last major study of the problem of terrorism. That was the National Intelligence Estimate that was done in 1995. So for 6 years, nothing was done in a way that really addressed the problem of strategic intelligence. And they quote a former director of the Counterterrorism Center saying, strategic intelligence never saved a life. This is a terribly dismissive remark, and it points to the third problem within the report. That is the failure of the Counterterrorism Center that was created in 1986. This wasn't a new body. The report keeps talking about the inexperience and the junior nature of the analysts at the Counterterrorism Center. This group had been around for 15 years prior to 9/11 and missed so many analytical clues and did so little analysis. And when you talk about sharing, it's not that the CIA and the FBI didn't share intelligence. There was very little sharing going on between the CIA itself or within the FBI itself. And on the level of intelligence community sharing with agencies who are on the front line of defense, like the Federal Aviation Agency or INS or State Department visa officers, they weren't getting any information whatsoever. Let me say one thing, though, about the failure of the report, because the report is not as strong as a document as I would like to see, particularly in the one area of accountability and responsibility. Here, the report just punted the major problem that it should have examined. Who is responsible for all of this? The report doesn't deal with any of that, and they return to the agencies themselves to do independent studies of an assessment of accountability and responsibility. And also, the report, even though it was done by the Senate Intelligence Committee and the House Intelligence Committee, they don't assess their own blame, their own responsibility. For 10 years, you had Senator Shelby from Alabama and Senator Graham from Florida not getting intelligence on terrorism. As I said, the last estimate was done in 1995. Why didn't someone on the staff of one of these committees go to the intelligence community and tell them, look, you're showing us raw data about terrorism, but you're not analyzing this problem? There's no attempt to do strategic intelligence. And this was the failure, of course, from the inability to watch the weakness, decline, and eventual collapse of the Soviet Union. And the final thing that's missing in terms of the failure of the report that you had, say, in the Pearl Harbor studies 60 years ago, was that the absence of any central mechanism or central repository for collecting all of this data, any compliance mechanism. If Tenet was going to issue a fiat on a war on terrorism, how did he know it was being carried out? The fact is it wasn't, but he had no way of knowing this. He had no feedback mechanism. And the final tragedy in all of this is that indeed it is 60 years after Pearl Harbor. We had the same kind of intelligence failure we had 60 years ago, in which the assumptions of CIA and FBI were entirely wrong, and they were never reexamined as the data kept pouring in. So it's not an issue of where is the smoking gun. You never get a smoking gun in the intelligence business. You get various pieces of a mosaic, and you have to put that mosaic together to make a picture. And the intelligence community and the CIA had so much information in terms of the Phoenix memo, the Minneapolis memo, the tracking of al-Hazmi and al-Madar, the inability to link Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to al-Qaeda for so many years. This tragedy could have been prevented. There's no doubt in my mind about that.
Well, you just went through that list very quickly, but for people who continually hear these names but forget what they reference, could you quickly go through what you've just referenced, the Phoenix memo, the Minneapolis memo, even the names of the people you referred
Certainly.
To?
Certainly. The Phoenix memo is extremely important because you have someone in a field office in Phoenix who sees the pattern at a flight training center in Arizona in which Arabs are being sent for flight training, who have very little knowledge of aircraft, who have no credit cards but cash, who are paying for these courses with cash, and don't seem to have any need to fly the large kinds of planes they're taking lessons on. All he asked FBI Central Headquarters to do was to task other field offices to look at flight training centers in their states. Florida and California certainly come to mind. And the FBI did not even task its sources to look into this or to ask a field office to look into this. They were entirely dismissive. And, of course, the Minneapolis memo deals with that very brave soul, Colleen Rowley, who had all of the evidence that was needed against Moussaoui, but the FBI didn't even understand their own Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and didn't realize they could have put a tap on his phone and they could have gotten into the hard drive in his computer. But again, Raleigh's memo was totally ignored. Now, on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, this is probably the number two man to bin Laden himself. A lot of people feel, I know I do, that he was the brains behind the operation, certainly the brains behind 9/11. He was indicted for his role in the World Trade Center bombing in 1993. It took years for the CIA Counterterrorism Center to link Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to al-Qaeda. So this was a terrible oversight. But let me say one thing, because the FBI is getting off the hook in a terrible way here. The FBI keeps saying that if they had the names of al-Hazmi and al-Madar, if they had been on a watch list, they could have watched these people and picked them up. Well, those names were well known to the Counterterrorism Center. And the Counterterrorism Center, even though it's housed at the CIA, is a multi-agency vetting center for all intelligence, you had FBI agents who were on duty at the counterterrorism center. You cannot tell me that these FBI agents didn't see the raw traffic that dealt with al-Hazmi and al-Madar. Why didn't they tell their own agency, hey, we have people with al-Qaeda links who were apparently in the first place trying to get to the United States and ultimately got to the United States, were living openly in San Diego. Their names were in the phone book, for crying out loud, and the FBI couldn't track these down. The performance of the FBI was abysmal. The CIA was terribly bad. The FBI was even worse.
We're talking to former CIA and State Department analyst Melvin Goodman. He's a professor of international relations security studies at the National War College. We'll be back with him, as well as Stephen Push, a spokesperson for the families of 911. He lost his wife, Lisa Raines, on American Airlines Flight 77 that crashed into the Pentagon. And we'll explore, well, for Nixon, it was the 18-minute gap, the 28-page gap, those pages that have been classified within the report that we don't get to see about U.S. and particularly Bush allies, Saudi Arabia. Stay with us. The long day is over. Nora Jones here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests are Melvin Goodman. Melvin Goodman is a former CIA and Defense and State Department analyst. He is a professor at the National War College. We'll also be joined by Stephen Push, lost his wife on the American Airlines flight that went into the Pentagon. Juan?
Well, Melvin Goodman, I'd like to ask you, the report specifies that it found no connection between Saddam Hussein and Iraq and any of the events of September 11th. How damning is that in terms of the Bush administration's continually trying to link Saddam and so many Americans believing that he is linked to the attacks?
Well, it's terribly damning, and it's just part of this overall picture of the misuse of intelligence by the Bush administration that got us into war. There was no evidence of link, and George Tenet also is culpable here because he sent a letter to the Congress in October of 2002 saying there were signs of links between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden and Iraq and al-Qaeda. But I have never talked to an intelligence analyst at any of the major agencies who said he saw any evidence whatsoever that linked these two groups. And frankly, it's quite counterintuitive to think that a religious zealot like bin Laden would form ties with a secularist such as Saddam Hussein. So it undercuts a key part of the Bush strategy for going to war. And remember, Colin Powell made a big deal of this at his UN speech on February the 5th of this year. So it undercuts everyone in the administration who talked about this, and it does beg questions about, were we falsely led into this war? Were we misled? Were we deceived? Were lies told?
And what about the 28-page gap, all the references to Saudi Arabia's involvement or possible links of Saudi Arabians to the attackers?
Well, this is particularly appalling on several levels. One, I don't have to remind people that 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. And I said after 9/11 that you should not forget that this was something that can be traced back to the brains that came out of Egypt, because a lot of the best minds on bin Laden's staff were from Egypt, and also the money that came out of Saudi Arabia. And here, this points to something we rarely hear about, the inability or unwillingness, actually, of the Treasury Department to really track the financial network of the terrorist organization, their incredible reluctance. But to get Saudi Arabia off the hook, given the terrible price that so many Americans paid, I think is particularly pernicious.
Let's bring Stephen Push into this conversation. Lost his wife, Lisa Raines, in the American Airlines flight that flew into the Pentagon. Your response to the congressional report released on Thursday?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question? I don't hear you too well.
Your response to the congressional report that was released on Thursday?
I think that the work that they did on the report was excellent. Unfortunately, it was not complete because they were denied access to critical documents that they needed. For example, the presidential daily briefing of August 6, 2001, and the minutes of the National Security Council meetings. And so the Joint Inquiry was not able to complete their work. I'm also concerned about the 28-page gap in the section on foreign involvement in 9/11. I think the American people have a right to know what role Saudi Arabia had in 9/11.
And what importance do you attach to this August 6th presidential briefing?
Well, what we know about the August 6th briefing is that the president was told that that Al-Qaeda may attack within the United States, and that it's possible that airplane hijackings may be part of the plot. We don't know more than that because the president won't release that briefing, but it seems very suspicious. What we know is very suspicious, and it concerns me that we don't have the whole story.
What, as a family member who lost someone on September 11th, how have you gotten information over the last 2 years, and what has brought you to the conclusion that Saudi Arabia is an absolutely key factor here?
Well, I went out and hired a private investigator with my own funds to try to get some information on the Saudi connection with 9/11, and what I was able to determine is that if the royal family was not itself involved, there are wealthy Saudis who are well connected with the royal family who have been funding Al-Qaeda from its inception right up until 9/11 and even after 9/11. And these people have been brought to justice. As far as I know, they're still living inside Saudi Arabia. They still have all of their wealth, and no attempt has been made by the Saudis to crack down on them.
Melvin Goodman, what could be, in your view,
regrettable? The financial aspect is very important, but just as important is the unwillingness of the Saudis to cooperate with us on, in terms of our intelligence needs, Bin Laden and the Bin Laden family. The Saudis just have not been cooperating in terms of intelligence exchange. And really, when you think about the destruction against Khobar Towers in 1996, that was 5 years before 9/11. So you have an entire pattern of Saudi Arabian heel-dragging on very important intelligence issues, which should never have been acceptable to the Clinton administration or the Bush administration.
But in your opinion, what's behind this reluctance to really go after the Saudis?
Well, I think the key to this is the oil aspect of the bilateral relationship. If the Saudis didn't have the largest reserves of oil in the world, we would have no interest in Saudi Arabia, just as if Iraq didn't have the second largest reserves of oil, I don't think we would have 150,000 American troops in Iraq. So once again, we're tethered to our oil needs. We're being held hostage by our own energy use, our inability to develop an energy policy, and it's paid with lives in this particular case.
And what about the special relationship between the Bush family and the Saudi regime? For example, just the small fact that President Bush Sr.'s library, the Saudi regime gave him $1 million to endow that.
I don't think the personal relationship is as important as the institutional relationship. If you look at the main driving force behind the war on Iraq, which was clearly Vice President Cheney, I mean, it was Cheney who was pushing the worst kinds of intelligence to make the case for war. It was Cheney who was knocking heads together at the CIA to get them to say things that would support the war, and it's Cheney, who has deep institutional ties to the energy industry and won't release documents dealing with his conversations that were part of this special relationship with energy and oil needs. So I think it was this institutional tie and the dependence on oil that had a lot more to do with it than the family tie. And also, I think it's regrettable that we've allowed basically Prince Bandar to remain in this country for so many years as ambassador and not be upfront in terms of how he has supported U.S.-Saudi relations. And he does such a good publicist job in terms of public relations and outright propaganda for Saudi Arabia that we don't get the kind of information we need from the ambassador, and I'm not sure if he's a reliable conduit or for the kinds of things we need to get back to the capital in Saudi Arabia.
We're also joined on the phone by Robert Fisk of the Independent newspaper in Britain. He is in Baghdad right now. Welcome to Democracy Now, Robert.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. We're discussing the congressional report that was released yesterday, and specifically the role of Saudi Arabia in this report, the 28-page gap that was redacted in the report. The Bush administration did not want the public to see the relationship between Saudi Arabia and 9-1-1. What about your research into this?
Well, I'm a long way away from Washington, of course, in New York. Well, my first reaction was that I don't think the Americans care very much about protecting the Saudis, but I do think they care very much about protecting anything that's embarrassing for the administration with the Saudis. I didn't hear the previous conversation, but I do ask myself what it might mention about Bush's relationship with the Bin Laden family, and also about the CIA's relationship with Saudi intelligence at a time when both the CIA and the Saudis were supporting Bin Laden and his associates in the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan. I always think, and it applies very much in British documents where you have this kind of blank page episode, that it's much more to avoid embarrassment to the authorities than to protect friendly powers abroad.
Stephen Push, I'd like to ask you, you lost your wife, Lisa Raines, in the attacks of September 11th. Where do you go from here, the families, in terms of being able to get the full story of what the government failed to do, did or didn't do, to prevent the attacks?
Well, we're putting a lot of hope in the independent commission that's headed by former New Jersey Governor Tom Kaine, which is to do a comprehensive report on 9/11 next year. They're going to look not just at intelligence, but at other areas as well, such as immigration policy, aviation security, et cetera. Unfortunately, however, so far they have been running up against the same kind of stonewalling that the administration gave to the joint inquiry. They have not, so far, they have not been able to get the presidential daily briefings. They have not been able to get the National Security Council minutes. And it's not clear the Bush administration is going to give them any more cooperation than they gave the joint inquiry.
Stephen Push, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Back to Robert Fisk in Baghdad. You have written about the Saudi family, the connections to Bush, and also see the Carlyle Group as cementing those connections. Robert Fisk. Whom we may just have lost. Well, as we get Robert Fisk back on the line, let's take a listen to just after the release of the congressional report, Vice President Dick Cheney gave a speech at the American Enterprise Institute. This is an excerpt.
The ability to criticize is one of the great strengths of our democracy, but those who do so have an obligation to answer this question. How could any responsible leader have ignored the Iraqi threat? Last October, the Director of Central Intelligence issued a national intelligence estimate on Iraq's continuing programs of weapons of mass destruction. That document contained the consensus judgments of the intelligence community based upon the best information available about the Iraqi threat. The NIE declared, quote, "We judge that Iraq has continued its weapons of mass destruction program in defiance of UN resolutions and restrictions. Baghdad has chemical and biological weapons, as well as missiles with ranges in excess of UN restrictions. If left unchecked, it probably will have a nuclear weapon during this decade. End quote. Those charged with the security of this nation could not read such an assessment and pretend that it did not exist. Ignoring such information or trying to wish it away would be irresponsible in the extreme. And our president did not ignore that information. He faced it. He sought to eliminate the threat by peaceful diplomatic means, and when all else failed, he acted forcefully to remove the danger. Consider another passage from last October's National Intelligence Estimate. It reported, quote, all key aspects, the R&D, production, and weaponization of Iraq's offensive biological weapons program are active, and that most elements are larger and more advanced than they were before the Gulf War, end quote. Remember, we were dealing here with a regime that had already killed thousands of people with chemical weapons. Against this background, to disregard the NIE's warnings would have been irresponsible in the extreme. And our president did not ignore that information. He faced it and acted to remove the danger. Take a third example. The NIE cautioned that, quote, since inspections ended in 1998, Iraq has maintained its chemical weapons effort, energized its missile program, and invested more heavily in biological weapons. In the view of most agencies, Baghdad is reconstituting its nuclear weapons program, end quote. Here again, this warning could hardly be more blunt or disturbing. To shrug off such a warning would have been irresponsible in the extreme. And so President Bush faced that information and acted to remove the danger. A fourth and final example, the National Intelligence Estimate contains a section that specifies the level of confidence that the intelligence community has in the various judgments included in the report. In the NIE on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, the community had high confidence in the conclusion that Iraq is continuing and in some areas expanding its chemical, biological, nuclear, and missile programs contrary to UN resolutions. The intelligence community also had high confidence in the judgment that, and I quote, Iraq could make a nuclear weapon in months to a year once it acquires sufficient weapons-grade fissile material, end quote. Ladies and gentlemen, this is some of what we knew. Knowing these things, how could we, I ask, have allowed that threat to stand? These judgments were not lightly arrived at, and all who were aware of them bore a heavy responsibility for the security of America.
Vice President Dick Cheney speaking yesterday at the American Enterprise Institute just after the congressional report came out. And you are listening to Democracy Now! Melvin Goodman, former CIA and State Department analyst, your response to what Dick Cheney was attempting to put out yesterday.
Well, this is the longest statement of disinformation that I think the American government has distributed to the American people. You know, the very obvious thing is, where are the nuclear weapons? Why haven't we found the nuclear weapons? Why haven't we found the evidence that he was really trying to import uranium and enrich uranium for nuclear weapons? Where are the Scud-type missiles that Cheney was talking about? Where are the hundreds and hundreds of tons of chemical agents that he said and the CIA said could fill 16,000 rockets? Where are the huge numbers of materials that were supposedly produced for thousands of liters of anthrax and botulinum toxin and all of the other biological agents that Colin Powell listed in his speech to the UN, which was written for him by the CIA after he turned down a version of the speech that was written for him by Dick Cheney's chief subordinate? Where is any of this material? You know, the fact of the matter is that there was no clear and present danger. There was no imminent threat. And for Dick Cheney just to recite these charges that we all know now not to be true just adds to the terrible politicization of intelligence that has created a scandal in the intelligence community unlike anything I ever saw in my 24 years at the CIA. That includes the period of Vietnam, the period of the intelligence failure on the Soviet Union, and the incredibly contentious disputes over arms control. The unfortunate thing is that George Tenet's hands aren't clean in any of this either, because he tried to have it both ways. In October, for example, and this is indeed important, the very month that George Tenet sent two memos to the NSC and called Stephen Hadley and told Hadley that he could not use the statement with reference to Iraq trying to obtain supplies of uranium, of so-called yellow cake. That was the same month that George Tenet endorsed, authorized, signed a national intelligence estimate that said many of the things that Dick Cheney just recited. So this is what I mean by George Tenet failing totally in his job as an intelligence coordinator or intelligence arbitrator. He gave evidence out there that is the critics of the war could use, and he gave a great deal of material out there that people such as Dick Cheney, who wanted this war so badly, could also use. And that's why this country now faces the terrible dilemma that it now faces and continues to witness the terrible situation we have in Iraq, where American lives are lost on almost a daily basis, and American treasure to the tune of about $4 billion a month is being spent to try to get through some transition period in Iraq from event which we're eventually going to have to withdraw from. This is a very sad spectacle, and Dick Cheney has just added to this terrible problem.
Well, Melvin Goodman, you talk about the inability of the administration to find any physical evidence, but there was a lot made during the period leading up to the invasion of the Iraqi scientists. And once the Iraqi scientists were able to freely talk about what kind of a program Saddam Hussein had, that the truth would come out. But yet we've seen no Iraqi scientists even brought forward by the administration to give eyewitness accounts of this alleged program.
Well, I agree with your point there. And the worst example of that is the fact that the United States is holding at the Baghdad airport the chief scientific advisor to Saddam Hussein, a man by the name of Amir Saadi. Now, I would have to think that if Amir Saadi were giving information to the United States that would be helpful to make the case that Dick Cheney has just alleged, I think we would be parading Amir Saadi before the National Press Club at some point, or to meet an American audience to make the case for us. But we're not doing that. Many of the scientists that we captured made it clear that these materials were destroyed in the 1990s. The so-called weapons of mass destruction. You know, the picture that's forming here is that at the very point when the CIA lost most of its intelligence collection, remember when the UN inspectors could not return to Iraq, we lost our major means of collecting intelligence against Saddam Hussein and against the weapons of mass destruction. That's when the CIA started doing its worst-case estimates. And I think it's axiomatic, certainly for my 24 years in the intelligence community, that the less intelligence you have, the more dire are your warnings because you're so afraid of the gaps in your intelligence. Clearly, what we had from 1998 on to 2003 were huge gaps in intelligence. For Dick Cheney to talk about the intelligence community speaking with confidence is incredibly fallacious. There was no confidence within the intelligence community, and most of the serious analysts took argument with a lot of the opinions that were coming out that were supported by George Tenet and others. A good example of that was the case of the aluminum tubes, whether they were for strategic arms or for conventional arms. The Department of Energy, which has the key expertise in this government for nuclear matters, made it clear that the aluminum tubing was for conventional arms, but Colin Powell still made a very shaky case at the UN for why the aluminum tubes could only be compatible with strategic arms. That's why the Niger documents were so important. They were a hoax, but they became important because if Saddam Hussein was indeed trying to get his hands on uranium, then it would lend some credibility to the very weakest part of the argument about reconstituting its nuclear capability, which was having the aluminum tubes, which I must add were obtained on the open market with open documentation. This is an odd way to obtain something to rebuild a nuclear program that was banned by UN resolution.
Well,
and then that brings you one final point. That brings you back to Dick Cheney. Who is the one person in the administration who was pushing the reconstitution of nuclear weapons and the nuclear program so hard? It's always been Vice President Dick Cheney, because that's the most compelling argument you could make about going to war. That's what would terrify the American people. The president talked about the mushroom cloud from nuclear weapons. Condi Rice very dramatically talked about the mushroom cloud from nuclear weapons. You know, of all the fraudulent aspects of the reasons why we went to war, the worst was the reconstitution of the nuclear capability, because no serious scientist or analyst in this city or at the United Nations believed any of it.
Melvin Goodman, we want to thank you very much for being with us, former CIA and State Department analyst. You are listening to Democracy. And when we come back, we'll talk to Robert Fisk, back with us from Baghdad. And then we're going to look at what Monsanto is doing to a Vermont dairy. We'll be speaking, among others, to Ben Cohen, who is founder of Ben & Jerry's, now with the True Majority. Stay with us.
Up there, the rattle of the milkman on the stair. Sure, that's music. Fine music, the singing of a sparrow in the sky, the perking of the coffee right nearby. There's my favorite melody. You, my angel, phoning me. I hear music, mighty fine music. And anytime I think my world is wrong, I get me out of bed and sing.
Billie Holiday, I Hear Music, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, Robert Fisk back on the line with us from Baghdad. In his latest London Independent article, he talks about the release of the photographs of Uday and Qusay Hussein. Robert, can you talk about the effect they've had and your thoughts about it, both the killings and the photos?
Yeah, well, you've just caught me as I've come back from doing a series of household trips around Baghdad to buy a plug for my bath and other things which you can't get in hotels here. And every shop I went into, I made a point of asking both the people buying products and the people behind the counter what they thought of the pictures. It was a very interesting response, partly because it lined up pretty much with what I thought it would be in this morning's paper, and partly because it's a kind of lose-lose situation for the Americans. More than 60% of the, I guess, 42, 43, 44 people I spoke to believed that the picture of Uday was Uday, but they believed, only a minority believed, that the picture of Qusay was genuine, because Qusay never had a beard, and he does in the photograph. Several Iraqis said to me, why didn't they shave his beard off before taking a picture of him? But of the majority who do believe in the Uday picture, unfortunately for the Americans, a majority of them believe he should have been captured and put before a court so that justice could be done and civil society could see real justice taking place, not a kind of drumhead court whereby you yell for the guy to surrender on a bullhorn and then storm the place with tow missiles and rocket-firing helicopters. An awful lot of Iraqis, by far the greater majority of those I spoke to today, complained bitterly that there was no justice in this, that if the Americans had wanted to take these two men alive, they would have done so. A couple of them mentioned Manuel Noriega, who was, of course, put under siege in an embassy and then was eventually got hold of. And I must say, I put this question to General Ricardo Sanchez, the American commander in Iraq, at a press conference he gave 3 days ago where he was boasting about the brilliance of his troops in Mosul. And I said, hold on a second, General, we've got a problem here. These guys, and your president said this as well, should have been put in a war crimes trial. There should be justice here. Surely the American military, the most powerful in the world, could have surrounded that house. They'd only had four men with Kalashnikovs. And one of them, in fact, which is not being talked about very much in the United States, was not a man. He was a 14-year-old boy. He was Qusay's son, Mustafa. You couldn't even capture them. What went wrong? And he said, oh, it was an operational decision. And I said, this is an operational question, General. And he said, there was a question that had to be answered by men on the ground, and they did that, and I agree. And that was that. But an awful lot of people, including, I should add, quite a few American officers here, take the same view as I do. In fact, a colonel came up to me after the general had finished being rather snotty with me and said, that was a good question, and I noticed he didn't give you a proper reply. And I said, well, of course, I noticed that too. It seems to many Iraqis that the intention was to kill them, not to capture them, that the attempt to make them the four people, individuals, I note, Sanchez called them. He didn't want to mention the child, of course. The attempt to make them surrender was pretty much a formality. And it does suggest that no quarter was going to be given if Saddam gets surrounded, that the Americans want him dead. And that, of course, has not gone down so well with the Iraqis. The strange thing is that even those people who have no reason to love Saddam, and people, I met young one young man who would actually rather like, or two, in fact, who'd rather like to have personally shot Uday in the face. They both started saying things like, well, at least he didn't die of cowards. And when I said, well, it looks like Uday may have shot himself because of the wounds, the injuries to the teeth and the nose, his response was, well, at least he left the last bullet for himself. And in a society like this, which is a tribal society rather than a Ba'athist society or a religious one or a secular one, the idea of going down fighting against a foreigner and leaving the last bullet to yourself is not an unheroic one. And the real fear, I think, here, I don't think the Americans or even the British have spotted this in their marble palace from which they organize their occupation here. The real fear, I think, is that in death, Uday and Kusei will be relieved of their brutalities in the national memory and will become among the first fighters to struggle and die against the American occupation force, I mean, after the war was over. And everybody I spoke to today, without exception, including the most mild-mannered middle-class people, including the father of my own driver, who's a friend of mine, all said the Americans must go, they must go now, we don't accept occupation forces in this country. I noticed out at Dora yesterday, which is a long main highway near the power station that runs along the Tigris River, a new graffiti had gone up in red paint very close to the scene of an ambush of an American Humvee a little earlier on in the day. And it said on it, there are 27,000 warriors from the Al-Jabura tribe. This is a tribe which is close to the Dacriti clan of Saddam Hussein, who are ready to threaten and throw the Americans out of Iraq. If you go down to places like Fallujah and other, Ramadi, for example, places which have been characterized by the United States as being diehard loyalist, Ba'athist, remnant areas, many of the people didn't like Saddam Hussein and say they don't like him, but they are adamant the Americans must leave and are beginning to truly hate the Americans. It was very interesting. The other day, there was a young American soldier blown up by a mine in his Humvee at a place called Handari, which is 6 miles from Fallujah, and I went down there. Unfortunately, I was the only reporter to turn up, so of course I was confronted by a very hostile crowd afterwards. I seem to be my fate to be confronted by hostile crowds. The Americans were still there clearing up the damage and taking away their ruined vehicle. They'd got the young soldier away. Apparently, he had terrible wounds to his side, and of course, he sadly died. And when I spoke to the crowd there, they appeared to be Wahhabi Sunnis who had no love for Saddam but were enraged by the presence of the Americans. I think there's a whole series of reasons why this happened. One of them was the shooting dead of 16 demonstrators by, I think it was the 82nd Airborne, in the very early days of the occupation, once the bombardment of Iraq was over. And following from that, various tribal demands for revenge against the Americans to make up for the deaths of Iraqis. And children, for example, regularly stone U.S. troops now in the whole Ramadi Fallujah area. I went down a few weeks ago, actually, to Fallujah, where there was a house-to-house search going on after the death of a 101st Airborne soldier who was killed with a rocket-propelled grenade. And there was a very nice New York police officer who was serving the military police who started chatting to me and said, you can come and, you know, he's okay, he kept shouting to the other soldiers. And I was allowed to go across the lines and actually go around the houses as the American soldiers kicked in the doors. Though one was very grateful for the feelings of freedom that the American had towards the press.
Robert, we have 30 seconds.
Hello there?
Hi, we have 30 seconds.
Okay, what I saw gave me the impression that they were losing hearts and minds, not winning hearts and minds. And at the end of the day, that is what the Americans have got to deal with, a hostile population. It's not about Saddam anymore.
Robert Fisk, I want to thank you very much for being with us of The Independent now in Baghdad. One of his latest pieces says the publication of the Uday and Kusei photographs will prove to be either a stroke of genius or a historic mistake of catastrophic consequences. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move now into our last segment, it is a multinational corporation at home. Biotech giant Monsanto recently filed a lawsuit against a small milk producer in Maine, in Vermont, Oakhurst, that advertises its milk contains no artificial growth hormones. Monsanto claims the advertisements give the public the impression artificial growth hormones are not safe. Monsanto claims that by doing this, Oakhurst is directly disparaging Monsanto's product, Posilac, the only artificial growth hormone on the market. Monsanto boasts the hormones help cows produce up to 15% milk, but there have long been concerns of the effect of the hormones on both the cows and humans. We're joined now by investigative reporter Jane Akery, who sued Fox as well as Monsanto when she and her husband tried to broadcast reports that they had done on Monsanto, but were prevented from doing that, and by Ben Cohen. He is the president of the True Majority, which is calling for an investigation into the allegations around weapons of mass destruction. But he also founded Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream and has had to deal with Monsanto in the same way that the Maine dairy Oakhurst has. Ben Cohen, let's first get your comment.
Well, throughout the history of trying to foist RBGH on the population and the world, Monsanto has used incredibly high-handed tactics to silence opposition. Here in Vermont, in order to get BGH approved at the state level, they launched the biggest lobbying campaign that Vermont has ever witnessed. You know, suing farmers has been something that this multinational has been doing throughout the attempts to get RBGH accepted. You know, Ben & Jerry's wanted to print on its labels that we don't use RBGH, and Monsanto had pressured various state legislatures to pass legislation that prevented us from saying that on our labels, and we eventually had to go to court along with Stonyfield Farms and a few others. And eventually there was an out-of-court settlement, and we were able to print a statement that says we oppose the use of RBGH. Our farmers pledge not to use it, and then we were required by the FDA to include a statement that no difference has been found between milk with RBGH and without RBGH, of course.
Ben Cohen, I'd like to bring in Jane Akery, the investigative reporter who also examined the dangers behind Monsanto's artificial growth hormone. Welcome to Democracy Now, Jane.
Thank you.
Your reaction to this latest incident of Goliath suing David?
You know, this is Monsanto's MO. This is what they do. This is how they bring their products forth. If they're proud of their products, why do they have to use these sort of tactics? This is just one in a series, as Ben mentioned, of farmers that they have sued and continue to sue right now to get their products out there. I noticed a statement that Monsanto's spokesman said that Monsanto has not filed similar lawsuits, but this is precisely what they did when the product was approved by the FDA in 93 and farmers started labeling that they don't use the Monsanto's bovine growth hormone. In 94, they filed two similar lawsuits, one in Waco, Texas, and one in Davenport, Iowa, that said stop labeling. And these two small dairies, they picked very small dairies, didn't have a leg to stand on. They stopped labeling. And then Monsanto hired a Washington, D.C. law firm and sent letters out to other dairies around the country that said, who's next? You label, we will sue you too. The end result is that the consumer will not have a choice at the grocery store shelf, and that is exactly what Monsanto wants to accomplish.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both for being on with us for this brief time. Ben Cohen, founder of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream, now president of the TrueMajority.org, and Jane Akery, who sued Fox and Monsanto for preventing her from issuing news reports. She won in a lower court, overturned in a higher court. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a video or audio of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen Shroof, Abdul Qudus, Lenina Nadal, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.